If we could go ahead and get started. On behalf of the Owen Graduate School of Management and its Distinguished Speaker Series Board, I welcome you here today. Today's speaker is Mr. John C. Bogle. He will deliver a speech entitled Humbled, Arithmetic, and the Soul of Capitalism. Mr. Bogle currently serves as the president of Bogle Financial Markets Research Center. In 1974, he founded and created the Vanguard Group, where he served as chairman and CEO until 1996, and senior chairman until 2000. He was associated with the predecessor company since 1951, immediately following his graduation from Princeton University, magna cum laude in economics. He's a graduate of Blair Academy, class of 1947. The Vanguard Group is one of the two largest mutual fund organizations in the world. It comprises more than 120 mutual funds, with current assets totaling over $830 billion. The Vanguard 500 Index Fund, the largest fund in the group, was founded by Mr. Bogle in 1975. It is the first index mutual fund. A book signing will follow this reception in the lobby of the Owen School. Representatives of the bookstore will be on hand to sell copies of his most recent book, The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism, in which Mr. Bogle argues that money managers have put their own financial interests ahead of those investors they represent, and the financial system has robbed investors of trillions. In reviewing The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism, U.S. News and World Report said, "Anyone who cares about the American business ought to be concerned about the dire warnings in this book." Mr. Bogle currently resides in Pennsylvania with his wife, Eve. They are the parents of 6 children and the grandparents of 12. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Bogle.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everybody. I've been called kind of a preacher in many aspects of my life, and I thought of trying to get to that pulpit, giving me a little more moral authority, perhaps. But I'm happy to be in the pulpit anyway, and when you hear this speech, I think you'll find that I'm in the right pulpit. Can you all hear me okay? Is that sound working all right? We have any number of mics here. How is that? Is that a little better? All right, good. We might as well clear up some of the technical difficulties before we get going. Let me begin by saying, of course, I'm deeply honored to be invited back to Vanderbilt as part of your Distinguished Speakers Series. As many of you know, both of my sons graduated from Owen. John graduated in 1983, and Andrew graduated just a little over a year ago in 2004. And they both benefited immensely from their education here. So I am a big Vanderbilt booster, and delighted that all of Vanderbilt and Owen has to offer to you. For God's sake, make the most of it. You're getting a great education here. Don't let it go by. Alas, I did not have the benefit of an MBA. I did learn a lot in my undergraduate years at Princeton, not only garnering a broad liberal education focused on the values of Western civilization, which I think is still important, but it also gave me an intellectual curiosity. We talked a little bit about this at lunch, that has kept my mind, such as that mind may be, alive, alert, and challenged. As an economics major, I also received, I think, a pretty solid grounding in what is called, as you all know, the dismal science. And not only that, but a ticket to my long career in the financial field. It was at Princeton, actually, almost 56 years ago. I don't want to think about it. But I happened upon the December 1949 issue of Fortune magazine and learned for the first time that something existed out there called the mutual fund industry, of all things. When I saw the industry described in a way that I think almost describes me, described in the article as tiny but contentious, I knew immediately I'd found the subject for my Princeton senior thesis, which was then, and it is now, a requirement for a Bachelor of Arts degree at Princeton. Over the next 18 months, after that wonderful, wonderfully lucky break, I spent countless hours. I really worked hard on it, researching and writing that thesis. Very little public information existed about this tiny field, it was almost unknown at that time, of mutual funds, then consisting of just about 130 mutual funds with assets. The whole industry had assets of $2.5 billion. Then the industry was just beginning to grow. We'll try the first chart here. And despite a few dry spells, this is obviously a semi-log chart, you can see them there in 1973, 1978, and again in 2000, 2003, each of which were related to a 50% decline in the stock market, big bear markets, has continued to grow apace over time. Actually, the industry has grown an annual growth rate through that period of 16% a year during my career. It must be among the fastest, if not the fastest growing industry in America. Today, there are 8,000 mutual funds, not 130, and not $2.5 billion, but $8 trillion. Now, if you read that Princeton thesis today, you'd probably impress you, I think, no more than workmanlike, maybe a little callow, but above all, shamelessly idealistic. And not to flack a couple of my other books, but you can actually read the thesis because it was published 5 years ago in my book, John Bogle on Investing, the First 50 Years, proving, if nothing else, that if you wait a half century, anything can be published. On page after page, if you look at it, my youthful idealism speaks out, calls out again and again for the primacy of the interest of mutual fund shareholders. At the very opening of the thesis, I get right to the point, quote, mutual funds must not in any way subordinate the interest of their shareholders to other economic roles. Their prime responsibility must always be to their shareholders. Important advice, by the way, that this industry seems to have ignored in at least most evidently the market timing scandals that Attorney General Elliot Spitzer discovered in 2003. Later in the thesis, I wrote, there's some indication that costs are too high, do tell, and that future industry growth can be maximized by concentration on a reduction of sales charges and management fees. There again, alas, my advice fell on deaf ears. After analyzing fund performance, I concluded, mutual funds may make no claim to superiority over the market averages, the market indexes, which was, an early harbinger of my decision to create, a quarter of a century after I wrote those words, the world's first index mutual fund. Still later in the thesis, fund influence on corporate policy should be in the best interest of shareholders and not in the special interest of fund managers. Again, my advice, you're probably seeing a pattern here. My advice fell upon deaf ears, fell by the wayside, and shareholders even today, all those years later, 56 years later, remain ill-served by the passive governance policies followed by most mutual funds to this day. My conclusion powerfully reaffirmed another idea that I still hold. The role of the mutual fund is to serve the needs of both individual and institutional investors, and to serve them in the most efficient, honest, and economical way possible. The principal function of investment companies, mutual funds if you will, is the management of their investment portfolios. Everything else is incidental. While this advice too has been largely ignored, my creation of Vanguard is a truly mutual fund group, owned by our fund shareholders and operated on an at-cost basis, was my attempt to walk the walk that I talked the talk about a whole quarter century earlier. As I look back today, I can assure you, it may be obvious already, that my youthful idealism hadn't changed. Indeed, it's shamelessly reflected not only in Vanguard, but in both of the themes that now attract most of my attention. One is my profound concern with a pathological mutation from traditional owner's capitalism designed to serve corporate shareholders to the recent and virulent form of manager's capitalism designed to serve primarily corporate executives. This theme is the subject of this new book of mine, The Battle for the Soul of Capitalism, which has just been published by Yale University Press. The other theme is what I call the relentless rules of humble arithmetic, essentially an utterly simple mathematical approach to understanding investment issues that cuts through much of the mystery and double talk of today's financial systems. Let me begin with some words about the broad societal concerns that I express in the new book. Today's capitalism has departed not just in degree but in kind from its proud traditional roots, beginning with the Industrial Revolution, back when the 18th century turned into the 19th. It was a system that served us well, albeit imperfectly, with remarkable success for the better part of two centuries, a free enterprise system based on trusting and on being trusted. The system worked, or at least it did work. And then, late in the 20th century, something went wrong. The system changed. One more aberration. There have been a lot of them in the long course of capitalism. Well, each of those earlier failures was followed by safeguards put in place as a defense against future abuses. None of them, of course, ever contemplate the next scandal that almost inevitably follows. What went wrong this time, as journalist William Pfaff described it, was a pathological mutation in capitalism. The classic system, owner's capitalism, had been based on a dedication to serving the interests of the corporation's owners and maximizing the return on their investment. Not very complicated. But a new system developed, manager's capitalism, in which, Mr. Pfaff wrote, the corporation I'm quoting here came to be run to profit its managers in complicity, if not conspiracy, with accountants and the managers of other corporations. Why did it happen? Continuing the quote, because the markets had so diffused corporate ownership that no responsible owner exists. This is not, concluding the quote, this is not only morally unacceptable, but a corruption of capitalism itself. These issues go far beyond the importance of returning capitalism to its owners. Once empowered, as they will be eventually, the owners themselves must be both motivated to exercise their rights of corporate citizenship and required to observe their responsibilities as corporate citizens. This is not going to be an easy task. For in a sea change that has gone largely unnoticed, we've moved from being a society, I'll talk more about this in a few minutes with some data, in which individual stock ownership was held directly by individual investors, to one overwhelmingly constituted by investment intermediaries who hold indirect ownership, not direct ownership, on behalf of the beneficiaries they're supposed to represent. Our society today, then, I hate to tell President Bush this, is no longer an ownership society in which direct owners of stock hold voting control over corporate America. Rather, effective control is now held by a mere 100 financial institutions owning 58% of all corporate stock, 100 institutions. We've become an agency society, and we are not going back. But the agents, who are of course largely mutual fund managers and corporate pension trustees, have failed to represent, first and foremost, their principals. Who are those principals? Pension beneficiaries and the owners of mutual fund shares. If we all work long enough and hard enough at the task, we can create a fiduciary society, however, in which the citizen investors of America, that's basically you and me, will at last receive the fair shake they have always deserved from our corporations, one-third of the book, our investment system, the second-third, and the mutual fund industry, the third-third of the book. The fact is that our public, private, and individual retirement savings, the backbone of our financial system, have been seriously endangered, in important measure because our intermediaries have consumed far too large a share of the returns, whatever returns our financial markets are generous enough to provide. Far too small, therefore, a portion of those returns have been delivered to the last line investors who have put up all the capital and who have assumed all of the risks. Let's consider 9 of the consequences of this change in capitalism, 3 in each of these 3 areas, corporate, investment, and mutual fund America. I'm going to only spend about 1 minute. We're going to go through pretty quickly here, 1 minute on each of them. In corporate America, first, the staggering increase in managers' compensation. CEO pay has risen from 42 times the compensation of the average worker in 1980 to nearly 340 times currently. There it is. A 756% rise after inflation. The real income, after inflation income of the average worker, however, has barely kept pace. You can see that, $14,900 to $15,900, barely kept pace with the cost of living. Long ago, Herbert Hoover, one of the few businessmen ever to serve as president, put it well. Quote, the only trouble with capitalism is capitalists. They're just too darn greedy. Just imagine what Herbert Hoover would say today. Second, the rise of financial engineering. In a remarkable manipulation of financial statements, Corporations' earnings are now managed to meet the guidance that our executives give to Wall Street, quarter after quarter after quarter. Two of the prize tools for these earnings shenanigans are, one, mergers that are made, not with a sound business rationale, but because of the consequent opportunity to manage pro forma earnings by creating a veritable cookie jar of reserves to be drawn on at will to present a false picture of corporate growth. And two, even worse, arbitrarily, I'll talk about this more later, raising the assumptions for future returns on corporate pension plans, often as prospective returns, in fact, were eroding, which created a virtual Golconda of illusory earnings. Result, the gross inadequacy of pension plans to cover payout liabilities to future retirees is well on the way to becoming our next financial scandal. You heard it here. Third, the failure of our traditional gatekeepers in the recent era, our auditors, through their provision of highly profitable, you know this, consulting activities, became partners, if not co-conspirators, with managements and relaxed their traditional professional standards. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Regulators and legislators played their part. Our senators in 1993 forced the SEC to back down on requiring that option costs be treated as compensation expenses. Imagine that. And also seemed to ignore investor interest. That's finally being corrected 22 years later. And corporate directors have failed to provide adult supervision of these geniuses, that's a quote from the book, who manage these firms. Put more harshly, in an unattributed quotation I came across a few years ago, quote, when we have strong managers, weak directors, passive owners, don't be surprised when the looting begins. And so it was at companies that are well known to all of you. So much for corporate America. Let's move on to investment America. First, the vanishing ownership society, which I spoke of before. Direct holdings of stocks by individual investors have dropped from 91% of all stocks, only 32% today, as corporate control has fallen into the hands of giant financial institutions, pension funds and mutual funds, whose share has soared commensurately from 9% back then to 68% now. It's the other side, the other reciprocal of those numbers. It's a real ownership revolution that's gone largely unnoticed. I'll ask these agents, beset by conflicts of interest and a desire to feather their own nests, have failed to place front and center the interests of their principals, passively allowing corporate managers to look primarily after their own interests. Second, what I call the rise of short-termism. Part of this failure came because institutional investing moved from being an own-a-stock industry, holding an average stock for 6 years, the first 20 years I observed this business, to being a rent-a-stock industry, now holding a typical stock for less than a single year. While renters could hardly care less, look at that chart and see what's going on. When renters can hardly care less about corporate governance, owners must care and care deeply about their rights and responsibilities of ownership. And they have to exercise those rights and honor those responsibilities. Simply put, as I ask in the book, if the owners of corporate America don't give a damn about the triumph of managers' capitalism, if the owners don't give a damn, who on earth should care? Think about that. Third, under investment America, the triumph of illusion over reality. Think about this. As our professional security analysts, so-called professional security analysts, came to focus more heavily on the illusion, the momentary precision of the price of a stock, which is an illusion, they increasingly ignored the reality that what really matters is the inevitably vague but eternally transcendent intrinsic value of the corporation. Measuring up, unfortunately, to Oscar Wilde's wonderful definition of the cynic, our money managers came, quoting Oscar Wilde, to know the price of everything but the value of nothing. Thank you, Oscar Wilde. Yet the value of a corporation can be nothing more nor less than the discounted value of its cash flow. You all know that, you finance students, that's all there is. So when there's a gap between perception and reality, to state the obvious, it's only a matter of time until that gap is reconciled. Inevitably, you heard it here, it will be reconciled not in favor of perception, but in favor of reality. And now I turn to the mutual fund America and 3 points there. First, this industry has changed. When I came into it, mutual funds was a profession with elements of a business. Now it's a business with elements of a profession. Very important change. Our traditional guiding star of stewardship was transmogrified into a new star of salesmanship. Largely focused on management when I wrote that Princeton thesis during 1949-51, our predominant focus today is not on management, it's on marketing, increasing fee revenues by building up assets under management, often by creating, promoting, and advertising speculative mutual funds that meet the fads and fashions of the day. And our investors have paid a terrible price for that turn. Second, in the fund industry, the conglomerates have taken over. Think about this change. When I entered this field all those years ago, 100% of mutual fund management companies were privately held firms, relatively small and professionally managed. Today, since then, they've experienced their own pathological mutation. Today, 41 of the 50 largest fund management companies are publicly held, including 35 that are owned by giant U.S. and global financial conglomerates, usually managed not by professionals, but by businessmen who are bereft of investment expertise. To state the obvious, these conglomerates are in business to make a return on their capital and not a return on your capital, you as the fund investor. They cannot do justice to both, for the record is clear that the fund investor is at the bottom of the food chain. It is a truism that the more the managers take, the less the investors make. Third and last in the mutual fund industry, our failure to serve investors. Over the past 2 decades, for example, the annual return of the average equity fund has badly lagged the annual return of the S&P 500, largely because of fund costs, all those management fees, operating expenses, sales charges, hidden portfolio transaction costs. Further, the return actually earned by the average fund investor, largely because of poor timing and poor fund selection, has lagged by an even larger amount. In real inflation-adjusted dollars, the average equity fund investor has earned a shockingly small portion of the compounded return that was there for the taking simply by owning, yes, an index fund mimicking the Standard & Poor's 500. I will give you these numbers a little bit later in the talk. I think you'll be amazed. Such a shortfall, accurately described as the colossus by David Swensen, the integrity-laden and remarkably successful manager of Yale's endowment fund, as the, quote, colossal failure of the mutual fund industry, is simply an unacceptable outcome. Now, before I talk about my recommendations to reform corporate investment in Mutual Fund America, I want to turn to that second major theme I told you about, a simple, astoundingly simple methodology for understanding some of these problems that I've just described. I'm inspired by this wonderful, wonderful quotation I came across a few years ago when I was rereading Other People's Money, a pretty worthwhile book published in 1914 and written by Louis Brandeis, later to become one of the most influential Supreme Court jurists in the history of the nation. He railed against the oligarchs who a century ago not only controlled investment America, but corporate America as well. He described their self-serving financial management and interlocking interests, as he had a good way with words, this guy Brandeis, trampling with impunity in laws human and divine, obsessed with the delusion that 2 + 2 = 5. He predicted, accurately as it turned out, that the widespread speculation of that era would collapse, quote, a victim of the relentless rules of humble arithmetic. He then added this unattributed warning, I think it's from Sophocles, remember, O stranger, arithmetic is the first of the sciences and the mother of safety. These quotations hit me like a ton of bricks. Why? Because the relentless rules of arithmetic are so obvious, and I was told long ago by one of my detractors that all I had going for me was the uncanny ability to recognize the obvious. The curious irony about that is that most people either seem to have difficulty seeing what is in plain sight right before their eyes, or perhaps even more pervasively, refuse to recognize the reality because it flies in the face of their deep-seated beliefs, their biases, and even worse, in their own self-interest. To make this point, I'm going to give you the mathematical point. I'm going to give you three examples of how these relentless rules apply to investing. First, the basic arithmetic explains why investors as a group cannot and do not earn the return generated in the financial markets. Second, the arithmetic explains the failure of mutual funds to provide acceptable returns to their owners. And third, the arithmetic that explains why future projections of pension fund returns by corporate managers will not be achieved. Let's start at the beginning. Why can't investors earn the returns that our stock and bond markets deliver? Simply because a net return that actually gets delivered to investors, talk about obvious, is represented by the gross return in the financial markets minus the cost of financial intermediation. If the costs are 2% and the market does 10, the investors will divide up 8. It's not complicated. While truly staggering amounts of investment literature have been devoted to the EMH, the efficient market hypothesis, precious little has been devoted to the CMH. That's my formulation. I think it has a nice ring to it. The cost matters hypothesis. However, to explain the dire odds that investors face in their quest to beat the market, we don't even need the EMH. Whether markets are efficient or inefficient, investors as a group fall short of market returns by precisely the amount of the aggregate costs they incur. This is the central fact of investing. Yet there's strong evidence that the EMH is powerful and that it provides a sound explanation for how our financial markets work. Even its antagonists would agree that, however uncertain its application, carries a lot of theoretical truth. But the evidence in favor of the much-ignored CMH is overwhelming. Its application is obvious, and there's no question about its truth. It is a tautology. In fact, the CMH is a far stronger and more powerful hypothesis than the EMH itself. It is inevitably true. Yet what do we see in the pages of our statistical journals and financial journals? Statistical studies of rates of market return that are neither achievable nor achieved, and the search for alpha, a number reflecting the risk-adjusted return of a given portfolio, as you know, relative to the market itself, remains the holy grail of investing. How can we talk about creating positive alpha without realizing that after intermediation costs are deducted, the system as a whole has a negative alpha? This is not complicated. Think about this. Of what use is it to speculate on the amount of the equity risk premium, the amount by which stock returns may exceed risk-free investments, when 100% of the return on the 10-year Treasury note is there for the taking, while as much as 50% or more of the real returns on stocks can be consumed by our financial system, simply the cost of that system? How can we ignore the fact that as a group, apparently unlike those kids out in Lake Wobegon, we're all average before cost, and we're all below average when costs are deducted? This idea is half an old idea, interestingly enough, and half a new one. The old idea goes back more than a century, expressed by Louis Bachelier in his PhD thesis at the Sorbonne in France in 1900. Here's what he said: past, present, and even discounted future events are all reflected in market price. And that's essentially what the EMH says, long before the EMH was used. Half a century after that, 1950, Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson discovered that long-forgotten thesis. And Dr. Samuelson confessed that he, quote, oscillated between regarding it as a trivially obvious and almost trivially vacuous, and regarding it as remarkably sweeping. Whatever the case, Bachelier's analysis was, of course, right. When he went on to conclude, however, that the mathematical expectation of the speculator is zero, another quote from his thesis, Bachelier was wrong. For the fact is, the mathematical expectation of the speculator and the long-term investment alike is not zero. It is zero less the cost of playing the game, a shortfall to the stock market's return that's precisely equal to the sum of all those advisory fees and marketing expenditures and sales loads and brokerage commissions and legal and transaction costs and custody fees and securities processing expenses. And that's what the CMH says. Well, it said the more things change, the more they remain the same. And yet, paraphrasing Mark Twain, While the history of the era that Brandeis described is not repeating itself today, it surely rhymes. Every aspect of our investment system, our government retirement programs, our private retirement programs, indeed all securities owned by our stockholders of the group, is plagued by these same relentless rules. Since the returns investors receive, I think you're getting the point by now, come only after the deduction of system costs, even as a gambler's winnings come only from what remains after the croupier's rake descends, the relentless rules of humble arithmetic devastate the long-term returns of investors. Using Brandeis's formulation, we seem obsessed with the delusion that a 7% market return minus 3% for costs still equals a 7% investor return, that costs are too trivial essentially to be considered. This brings me to my second part of the point under the relentless rules, the nature of mutual fund returns. When we examine the record of the first two decades, you're going to be quite shocked by this. The relentless rules have proven dangerous to the wealth of the families that have invested in mutual funds and trusted their hard-earned wealth to us in the industry. That humble arithmetic, gross return minus cost equals net return, has destroyed their wealth in almost precisely the measure that CMH suggests. Investors have learned, I hope they have learned and learned the hard way, that in mutual funds, it's not that you get what you pay for, it's that almost tautologically, you get what you don't pay for. Think about that when you see these numbers. And now let's look at them. Over the past 20 years, a simple, low-cost, no-load stock market index fund tracking the S&P 500, let you guess which one it is, delivered an annual return of 12.8%. Just a hair short of the 13% return of the market itself. During the same period, the average equity mutual fund had about the same return before cost, we don't know exactly, but largely because of cost, a net return of just 10%, a shortfall of the index fund of 2.8 percentage points per year, and less than 80% of the market's annual return. Compounded over that period, each dollar invested in the index fund grew by $10.12. That's what we call the magic of compounding returns. Each dollar in the average fund grew by $5.73%. Not 80% is the annual case, but a cumulative case, a shriveled up 57% of the tyranny, a victim of the tyranny of compounding costs, not the magic of compounding returns. And it's about to get worse, because when we look at the return earned not by the average fund, but by the average fund investor, the shortfall to the market gets even greater. As this industry came to focus more and more on marketing and less on management, we deluged investors with all these speculative funds based on the fashions of the day, new economy funds, and our marketing experts respond to these trends with great alacrity. Aided and abetted by this industry, fund investors poured literally hundreds of billions of dollars, $600 billion in one 18-month period, into equity funds, speculative equity funds, as the stock market soared to its high, chose the wrong funds as well as the wrong timing. So in addition to the wealth-depleting penalty of fund cost, investors paid another substantial penalty for the counterproductive timing of their investments, and yet another substantial penalty for their unfortunate selection of funds. Now, inflation in intuition suggests that these costs were large. That we have data on this. It's not precise, but the fact is it confirms that hypothesis. Because we can calculate the dollar-weighted returns of mutual funds, quite easy to estimate by examining each fund's quarterly cash flows, and we know how much they lag the standard time-weighted returns, the way you usually see mutual fund returns expressed, by 3.7 percentage points a year. So now let's take those numbers out of it, leaving the investor, average fund investor, with a return of just 6.3%. Compounded over that period, each dollar invested in the index fund continued to grow to $10.12. Once again, the magic of compounding returns. Each dollar in the average equity fund by the average equity fund investor grew by just $2.39, 24% of the index fund's return, a victim not only of the tyranny of compounding costs, but the folly of fund choice. Put another way, and you can see it very clearly in these charts, in Warren Buffett's words, the principal enemies of the equity fund investor are expenses and emotions. And of course, Mr. Buffett is right again. You can see expenses in the top part of that chart, minus 3, and you can see emotions at the bottom of the part of the chart, minus another 3.7. Expenses and emotions, very clearly, are powerful enemies. But there are more. I'm not through with this baby yet. The true wealth accumulated in the index fund and the average equity fund shouldn't be measured in nominal dollars. They obviously have to be measured in real dollars after the impact of inflation. How much will that buy? Now, each return drops by 3%. That's not much of a surprise there. The real return for the index fund drops to 9.8 and to 3.3% for the equity fund. But an interesting mathematical fact, when we reduce both of these returns, annual returns, by an identical 3 percentage points to reflect the rate of inflation, compounding actually increases the gap in cumulative profit. Over the past 20 years, as you can see, the profit on each dollar initially invested in the equity fund comes to just, I don't think I did that right chart. I got to get this next one. Yeah, here's the inflation. I'm sorry, I should have put that up earlier. Comes to just 91 cents in real terms. It's a profit of 91 cents on each dollar, compared to a cumulative profit of $5.49 for the index fund. 16% to the investor. The rest, the other 84%, taken by the cost of the system and investor foolishness. And, of course, you don't think I'm through yet, do you? It gets even worse, for taxes are yet another enemy of the mutual fund investor. And with the high portfolio turnover that characterizes most funds, the average fund investor deferred almost no gains during that 20 years, resulting in substantial capital gains distributions year after year, with taxes in these gains, which reduce the returns, pre-tax returns of the investors, by another 2.2 percentage points a year. That's 2.2 out of 3.3. With its nominal turnover, on the other hand, the index fund deferred nearly all of its gains and made only nominal distributions, with taxes reducing shareholder returns by 0.9% annually, largely a result not of capital turnover, but of the tax on dividend income. As a result, the after-tax real return of the average equity fund, I haven't shown you this, drops to 1.1% a year compared to 8.9% for the simple buy-and-hold diversified low-cost index fund. I don't have the courage to put that in a chart and compound it. I'm sorry. You'll have to do that back in class. It's too frightening when you compound 8.9 as against 1.1, and I'm sure you get the point without my help. In short, simply the humble arithmetic of investing, logical, inevitable, unyielding, shows that investment cost, investor's choice, and taxes, to say nothing of the cost of living, devastate the real returns that mutual fund industries investors earn over time. Unless the fund industry changes, it will falter and finally fail, a victim of all things of, yes, the relentless rules of humble arithmetic. Now, to my final point, major point, projections of pension plan returns. Just as the mutual fund industry represents, at least in David Swensen's word, a colossal failure for investors, and the earlier arithmetic surely supports Mr. Swensen's point, so our pension fund system is on the brink of a colossal failure. Excessive return assumptions, insufficient contributions, and the almost universal failure to consider the profound long-term erosion of market returns engendered by investment costs have combined to create a serious shortfall in funding our private corporate pension system, but our governmental, state, and local pension systems as well. They say nothing of Social Security. They don't do the estimating differently, but the math is there. Much of the responsibility can be laid to the unwillingness of the corporate community to recognize those relentless rules of arithmetic. An estimate by Morgan Stanley puts that shortfall, that gap in corporate and pension plans, the shortfall of how much is there for the beneficiaries and how much needs to be there, at $1.6 trillion. That is a large gap, and we see it falling apart almost day by day. Here, much of the problem will arise in the future because pension fund trustees are projecting returns that rely heavily on historical past returns.
But future market returns, there's one point you're going to get out of this, are not determined by past market returns. My God, if that were so, the more the stock market rose, the more it would continue to rise in the future. A prospect that is absurd in its face. Rather, future returns in the market are based on the known sources of returns, and I want to spend a little time on that, that must and do drive the performance of the stock and bond markets. It requires no more than the essential, the ability to recognize the obvious, to apply these sources of returns to develop reasonable expectations about the future. Here are just two simple examples of this arithmetic. One is in the bond market. There's 10 years previous to the last 10. There's the previous 10 years, and here's where we are today. Over the past 10 years, looking at that only, Treasury bonds returned 7.5% a year, largely because the initial yield in the 10-year Treasury was, of all things, 7.8%. What relevance is that 7.8% in the years ahead with today's yield at 4.5%? Answer, none, zero, nada. The arithmetic confirms our correct intuition that today's yield is the best single forecaster of future bond returns. The correlation happens to be for today's yield, going back 100 years, from today's yield to the yield over the next decade, the correlation of the return to the initial yield is 91, not so far from a perfect correlation of 100. So our central projection today ought to be for a return of about 4.5% on bonds. I might give you 4.75% for a portfolio that includes both treasuries and corporates. 40% below the historical returns. What about the stock market? Well, the stock market has two kinds of return. The first is what I call fundamental return. Equally clear, obvious and equally clear, the investment return on stocks consists, not the total return, just the investment return, consists of the initial dividend yield plus the subsequent growth in earnings. During the past two decades, as you can see here, the stock market enjoyed an investment return of 10%, born of an initial yield of 5%, and earnings growth of 5%. Today, the dividend yield is not 5%, but 2%, a dead weight loss of 3 percentage points in future return. There's no way around it. If we're lucky enough to enjoy a continuation of that 5% growth, which seems probably realistic enough, the future investment return on stocks would be 7%, a 3% decline from the past. There's another kind of return that comes in here. It's what I call a speculative return. Together they add up to total return. Speculative return is simply the return that's born of any change, up or down, in the number of dollars that investors are willing to pay for each dollar of earnings, the P.E. ratio. And if that ratio remains unchanged, speculative return would, of course, be zero. During the past two decades that we're talking about here, the P.E. ratio went from 10 to 21 times after getting to a high of 34 times, or amazing, in 2000, an increase of 110%, or spread over the period, 4% per year. The mathematics are not complex. Seems to me unwise to expect an increase of that dimension to recur today, which would take our 21 PE to 44 times, even higher than at the peak a few years ago. And of course, today's relatively rich PE, my judgment, could even fall. But if we assume that the PE might end the period in extremes of, say, maybe as low as 18 times, it could be lower, or as high as 24 times, I doubt it can get much higher, such a 15% change, up or down, would just change our speculative return, change our investment return, by about one, plus or minus a percentage point, bringing the total return on stocks, as you can see in the chart, to as little as 6% and as much as 8%, but probably more like the 7% shown at the bottom of the chart. Interestingly, in a recent poll of corporate executives, the average return on stocks they expected was 6.4% per year, which is right in this range, actually on the low side of it. Number three, investment cost. You have to hear it once more. I see no reference to intermediation costs in the return projections made by corporate pension managers. It's not that they're not important. These costs for pension funds are well below mutual fund levels, of course. Maybe 1% is a reasonable amount to be included in the projection. If these corporate managers follow the, I think, unarguable arithmetic I've outlined here, a pension portfolio would earn, say, 7% on its assumed stock allocation of 60% of the portfolio, and 4.75% in its 40% allocation to bonds, a gross return of 6.1%, reduce that by a percentage point per cost, and the net return would be 5.1%. So while a typical U.S. corporation is using a projected return of 8.5% in its pension assets, simply recognizing the sources of market return and taking costs into account suggests a typical policy portfolio, 60-40, would produce a net return of 5.1%, 40% less. Imagine that compounded over 10 years. Ignoring the relentless rules of humble arithmetic has played a major role in creating that staggering shortfall of $1.6 trillion, previously described in pension assets relative to pension liabilities. It's high time that pension funds return to, great, thank you, relying, ta-da, not on irrational exuberance in projecting pension returns, but on rational expectations. Must be talking too long, won't go on too much longer. Thank you. Given the contentious nature of the issues I've discussed today, the powerful economic interests of these oligarchs around, the urgent need to face up to the changing world of capitalism, it is remarkable that almost no public discourse exists on these issues. In the investment community, I have seen no defense of the inadequate return delivered by mutual funds to its investors, nor of the industry's bizarre structure, no attempt by institutions to explain why the rights of ownership, one would think, are implicit in holding shares of stock, why those rights remain largely exercised. No serious criticism of the virtually unrecognized turn from the once conventional and pervasive investment strategy that relied on the wisdom of long-term investing and towards strategies that increasingly rely on the folly of short-term speculation. And at least until these last few weeks, when it's been off the page and the amount of copy it's gotten, very little discussion of the profound problems we are facing in our system of pension funding. If this book of mine helps to open the door to a little introspection by our corporate and financial leaders that's so long overdone, perhaps those changes will be hastened. Specifically, I call for the formation of a national commission to recommend policies that respond to the failure of our agency society, in which direct stockholders are an endangered species, and to take the steps necessary to ultimately eliminate the frightening shortfall in the expected future wealth of our vastly underfunded public, private, and individual retirement plans that are, in fact, the backbone of our nation's savings. These two problems are directly related and best solved by the creation of all things, a fiduciary society in which intermediaries truly represent first, last, and always, and only the interests of those they serve. But even if those recommendations for the development of an investor-oriented, not a manager-oriented, fiduciary society don't come to pass for a decade or more, as they probably won't, Adam Smith's legendary invisible hand, each investor acting in his or her own enlightened self-interest, will gradually think about it, bring about these changes. If we investors simply have the wisdom to put our own money where our own common sense dictates and the discipline to understand the relentless rules of humble arithmetic, then the system of financial intermediation that has failed so many investors in the modern era will change. One way or another, then, the soul of capitalism, the traditional owner's capitalism that served us so well, will be reclaimed. You all can help to solve these problems, believe me. Just understand these rules, do what's right, and please never, never, never lose your idealism. Thank you very much. Thank you.